Welcome to You've Got Time, an Orange is the New Black podcast. As per usual, I'm your host, Erin Quayle, and this week we spoke about the second episode of Orange is the New Black Season 4, and I chatted with Patrick Schmidt, who is the editor of Fansided and Netflix Life. So Fansided is the parent site to both Netflix Life and Hidden Remote, and, you know, Hidden Remote and Netflix Life are kind of like sibling sites under the Fansided umbrella. So we spoke about the episode, the episode itself, as well as some of the mental health and criminal justice components of the episode as well. As you know, as a viewer, the episode's kind of a little bit of a slower episode, so we did find a lot to talk about, though, and we hope you enjoy it. And so we also, in addition to the episode, talked about a Rolling Stone article on mental health on television, and that link, the link to that, will be on the post on Hidden Remote, as well as on our website, you've got time podcast.com. So a little disclaimer, I'm actually not a podcaster by trade. I, as you may know, I'm a therapist and a writer. So I flubbed the audio on this one a little bit. I had some help fixing it, but it's still not fantastic. If you are a podcaster or if you do have any audio recording experience, I would love some feedback on how I can record phone calls with excellent sound quality. So you can contact me per the usual routes. The podcast Twitter is at You've Got Time Pod. The Facebook is facebook.com/ You've Got Time Podcast. And our email is you've got time podcast@gmail.com. So, you know, I definitely welcome any expertise from anyone in the world out there that might be listening for assistance on this one. I'm definitely going to, you know, it's a learning process and I'm definitely going to work on that. And I hope you enjoy listening to it, even though it's a little scratchy, but we did have a great conversation and we're going to get this show on the road. So let's begin. So to kind of start off, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how the prison is so drastically changing this season. Joe is kind of changing. He was, you know, an ally for us for a really long time, or for the people on the show. I say us, but I'm too invested maybe. He was an ally for a while, and now he's kind of, you know, going into that MCC corporate life, and I'm not really loving it. But how are you feeling about that?
Yeah, it's been an interesting transition for Joe. I mean, heading into this season, we knew there was going to be tons and tons of new inmates at Litchfield. Obviously, you had those many bodies in the same size space. There's going to be some drama and some conflicts, and certainly season four was not lacking in either of those departments. Joe, you know, he's one of those guys that he means well. He tries to do good things. But he doesn't really seal the deal. It's a lot of half measures with him. Steal one of my favorite phrases from Breaking Bad. But he has good intentions, but at the end of the day, he kind of just buckles to the pressures from his employers and the MCC overlords, if you will. And I still kind of root for him to kind of just shackle those and just kind of, he's the warden. He's the director of human activity. He can be a boss. He can put his foot down, and he can, it's his prison to run. But, we're still kind of waiting for him to show some backbone here, and I wonder if we'll see it at some point.
Yeah, that's definitely true. I like what you said about the half measures, because even at the end of last season, instead of fighting for Sophia to be out of the shoe, he's kind of just like, well, I have to go along with it because something bigger might come up in the future, and I have to deal with this now so that I can, do good later. And we're not really seeing him do much of that in this season, which is disappointing, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. It's like he kind of avoided the problem with Sophia, the assault that happened with her, and the inmates or the correctional guards, they're not doing anything, literally just kind of running away from the problem. And that's kind of what Caputo was doing. He was like, all right, we'll put Sophia in the shoe. I don't need to worry about this problem right now. We'll just kind of put it on the back burner, until I'm kind of forced to deal with the situation. And So far early in season four, we're not exactly sure how that's going to play out. Some of the inmates are wondering where Sophia is. Little grumblings that Caputo did not handle that situation well, but this is
and another half measure with the earphones instead of actually addressing their problem.
Yeah, hey, free earplugs. That would be great for your new bunkmate that's snoring all night and you can't sleep. Yeah. But yeah, it's no real solutions. These problems are kind of they're not going away, and you're just introducing more problems on top of more problems and more problems. So instead of trying to address one problem and get a solution, or at least a semblance of a solution, it's just going to make these issues, more challenging and more difficult for Caputo and MCC to really address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's to borrow a phrase from my coworker who was on the first podcast, it's kind of like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound instead of, actually solving the problem, taking the bullet out and doing all the messy work. They're kind of just piling on top of that. And for MCC, it's definitely an issue with money. At one point, Joe's at a meeting, and one of the head guys, I think Danny's dad or whatever, he says they're getting $30,000 per head in a bed, which kind of confirms what Alito said in the earlier episodes about the fact that they're just bulk items now instead of people. And, Joe is kind of falling into that whole life a little bit in this episode. We see him buy an $1,100 suit. And I don't know if I think you're a fan of Arrested Development, and it reminded me of when Joe buys the suit. And he's like, this is an $1,100 suit, and the suit keeps getting more and more expensive. And that just, it was definitely a little disheartening to watch that happen and see how easily the, corporate, structure can kind of take over good, well-meaning people.
Yeah, the inmates in Litchfield, they're not Alita and Daya or Gloria and Sophia and Piper and, Alex and all these people. We know them by name and we love them, we hate them. Sometimes it's both of them in the same episode, but for MCC, it's, inmate and then whatever their inmate number is or whatever. They are bulk items or parcel items or whatever. So some of these, human rights or, natural rights that everybody should have, they're kind of being, thrown aside and cast aside here. And, it's MCC, those overlords. Like, it's the second time I've said overlords already in the first 5-10 minutes. So we'll see what the over-under can be on that.
I like it.
Yeah, but the $3,200 suit that Caputo buys, and his budding relationship with Linda, one of the other board members or members of MCC. I'm not exactly sure what her job title is, but they come up with the idea to now how can they get some cheap, inexpensive new COs, because all these new inmates. We saw the walkout with all the guards at the end of season 3. We see the introduction of some of these new correctional officers in season 4, and they want to make a great first impression. So Caputo and Linda, they're trying to brainstorm ideas, and they come up with the idea of hiring former military veterans, and that's a way to get cheap labor, and they could also get like a tax credit or some sort of credit where they're hiring veterans. So it's all about the almighty dollar and, turning a profit instead of, rehabilitation and, sending these people back out in the streets and being productive, citizens and part of the society. So, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the rest of season 4, this relationship with Linda and Caputo. I mean, Caputo, he's already got those lovey-dovey eyes going here. So it's going to be interesting to see how that all plays out.
Definitely. And kind of to go back what you're talking about, but, people is not humans, and they're kind of just looking to get them in and out of the system instead of helping them with future things, future issues. That's definitely something that the system as a whole has been, that they focus on a short-term solution instead of looking at the long-term. And it's causing more and more problems, kind of what we were talking about before as well. Instead of, giving them education and giving them what they need, they're kind of just cramming everyone into one thing. And in the end, it's creating more recidivism and more, people just can't do what they need to do once they get out of prison. And MCC obviously doesn't care about that because they just care about the bottom line. They want more product in their jail instead of having, instead of having, you know, people not come back to jail, obviously their end game is to have the overlords, their end game is to have things be as chaotic as possible, because they want people to just keep returning and going through that revolving door and getting them the $30K per head in a bed.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like, it reminds me of Shawshank Redemption, where, you know, Brooks, you know, he's, you know, released from prison, and then, you know, he just can't adjust. You know, he was locked up for so long. He doesn't equipped to handle all the changes, you know, on the outside world. You know, he only knew what he knew from inside those prison walls. And then when he was outside there in the real world, he didn't know how to adapt, cope, and react to all these new, you know, I guess, stimulants and, you know, all these different things that he had to react to. And, you know, it didn't end well for him. We saw Red, you know, the Morgan Freeman character. you know, wow, another Red in a prison show. That's crazy. But, yeah, you know, it's tough, and, you know, I know we don't want to go beyond season, you know, season 4, episode 2 here, but there are going to be some elements there later on in the season that kind of, you know, harbor back to, you know, the recidivist. I can't even say the word, so I'm not even going to try it, but, you know, helping people deal with, you know, life outside prison, and, you know, how they could cope, and whether or not they're just doomed to end up back behind the prison walls. You know, a few weeks later, we already saw the pasty in the season. It's weird, you know, people might forget that, you know, she was in Litchfield, then she was out, and then she came back. So, you know, that's one of the other, you know, hidden things that we might forget about. But Litchfield so far with Caputo at the helm, not doing a good job there in, you know, instructing and, you know, helping these inmates, you know, be better people.
Right. And with Tasty, you know, she was in and out really quickly. And in a real system, I always think about this, because in a real system, in a real federal prison system, they're not necessarily going to put an offender. Same with Alex, too, because Alex comes back to Litchfield as well after she goes out. They're not going to put them back into the same prison that they once knew. They could put them in a prison in Ohio or a prison in California or a prison in Texas. That, you know, they can dump them wherever they want to dump them, because instead of being a state prison, it's a federal one. So the show is a little bit kinder to the inmates in that respect, at least, because they're putting them. I mean, obviously they want them back on the show, so they're bringing them back.
Yeah, that's great TV that way. I mean, yeah. Yeah, it obviously makes for better TV when you can bring back Tasty and bring back Alex. It's such a nice, I guess, little rib in there, but or a little bow there. But, it's going to be interesting to see how Caputo, I guess, to kind of put a bow in this conversation here with Caputo and the prison organization and structure. It's, you know, I'm worried about Caputo. You know, like we said, we kind of want to root for him. He's like kind of a half good guy. Like, he thinks he's a good guy. He means well. He has good intentions, but at the end of the day, he's been faced with these, you know, big decisions on his plate, and time again, he's made one poor decision after another here. And, you know, at some point, you just got to wonder whether or not he got to stop rooting for Caputo and, you know, thinking he's a semi good guy, or this guy is just, you know, part of the NCC Corporation now, and he's, you know, a bad good guy. You know, we're rooting for the inmates, as, you know, backwards as that may sound.
Right. And to kind of transition into talking a little bit about the guards and the overcrowding, you know, Caputo, one of the very telling things about him here is Healy and Piscatella and Caputo kind of have a moment in the hallway where Healy fist bumps Piscatella, which I didn't really love that. And then Healy says something about Judy King, and Caputo said, "They love a recent graduate with no salary," quote, kind of threatening Healy's job if he doesn't fall in line. And that's, you know, that's definitely super telling about where Caputo's mind is going in terms of, you know, the prison structure and what he needs to do in order for the prison to survive. So, you know, it's definitely tough, but the overcrowding is obviously a necessary evil, because back in the beginning of season 3, Caputo had to bring NCC on for the prison to survive. And really, in the end, the only job he saved was his own.
Right.
He saved the structure of the prison, too, and we thank him for keeping that, you know, alive in the show. And, you know, with the bunkmates and the overcrowding, that's definitely, for the inmates, it's definitely negative and difficult. But for viewers, it's something that's, you know, definitely brings another level to the show itself. So that's this episode was a lot about adjusting for the inmates, I think.
Yeah, like you brought up that exchange there with Healy and Caputo and Piscatella. I mean, Healy is another one of those, like, half good guys. Like, you think he thinks he's a good guy. He thinks he has good intentions here, but, you know, every chance he's had to make a difference, a positive difference, you know, whether it was So-So, who was depressed and, you know, wanted proper treatment to handle her depression, he's just like, oh, yeah, you got a case of the blues, you know. And, you know, then we see her, you know, overdosing at the end of season three. So he's another one of those guys that it was an interesting, I guess, butting of the heads there with Caputo, kind of flexing his executive or management style muscles there, where he's like, hey, look, you need to do what I'm telling you. I'm the warden here. Do as I say. Otherwise, we're going to bring in some 24-year-old who, you know, will, you know, not, you know, charge us an exorbitant amount of money here. And again, yeah, it's all about the bottom line and turning a profit and not really about, you know, getting these inmates in and getting them out and, you know, being productive members of society again here. So it's a tug of war, I guess, if you will, here that we see play out over 13 episodes in season four.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And part of that war, in addition to the overarching war that MCC is kind of waging on the prison in general, we see, because of the overcrowding, we see smaller wars kind of start to brew between the inmates. And, you know, we see Red with snoring with her new inmate, which is actually really funny. We see Cindy kind of clash with Allison, the new Muslim inmate, who, you know, their religion sort of clash, but they also clash in terms of their space and what they, you know, what they're looking for in the bunk and power and all of that as well. So, and then we also have Maria, who is kind of taking advantage of the new situation, which is interesting because we really haven't seen much from Maria yet. And it was kind of interesting to kind of place that focus on her in this episode.
Yeah, Maria. I mean, it only took four seasons for her to kind of get her own kind of part in the spotlight here. You know, the first three seasons, you know, she was pregnant early on in the series. Mm-hmm. You know, she has the child. There's that heartbreaking scene where her baby and, you know, her husband or father of her child comes and on Mother's Day, and he's like, look, that was the last time you're going to see her, and until you come out, I don't want our daughter to see you locked up like this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was gut-wrenching and all that stuff. And then the scene with her and Daya, when Daya was thinking about putting her baby up for adoption, and Maria was like, you know, trying to, you know, kind of plead with her and help her understand, you know, just how difficult that would have been to be apart from her child. So really just kind of like two or three flashpoints that we've had of Maria in the first three seasons. And then, you know, season four early on, she's kind of, you know, in the first two episodes here, it's like, it looks like her and Lolly are going to be kind of like our breakout stars here, or breakout characters to watch in season four. And, you know, Maria, it's like you say, it's like these little subplots or these little, like, you know, minor conflicts or little mini wars or whatever taking place across Litchfield. It's like, you know, a lot of, pride of their homeland, or like, you know, where they're coming from and all that pride. And, you know, we see her flashback with, you know, her as a child, maybe 5-6 years old, something like that, with her dad, who was, I guess, like the top Dominican drug dealer in their little neighborhood where they're from. And it was all Dominican pride. And, you know, we hate, you know, other, you know, ethnicities and everything like that. It was all about culture pride and pride of your homeland and all this. You represent your country and all that well. And, you know, it all kind of goes back into the present where we have these new inmates. Sankey, her name is. She's, you know, she wants to watch something else on TV in the TV room. But Blanca and the rest of her friends, they're watching one of the FIFA qualifying matches with the Dominican Republic. And we kind of see the start of a little race war here, something like that happens in real life jails and prisons all across the country and the world, where, you know, it's not just, you know, an underground or you know, or whatever, like panty business, and just like all these fun little comedic tropes or whatever that we had in the first three seasons. Now we're getting into some hard and heavy hitting stuff here. I mean, we had the murder in episode one, and then episode two, we're kind of getting the start of, you know, what could be a full-on race war. And like you said, with Cindy and her new bunkmate, you know, a little bit of a religious war as well here too. So Maria kind of taking center stage there, and it's really interesting because, you know, there's so many characters. This show is so great because, you know, we have the main characters, Piper and Alex and Rev and Nikki and all these people, but what makes this show so great and why it's such like a great binge watch, you got 50 characters that, mm-hmm. you know, could really hold their own episode and, you know, really just adds to the drama and the storytelling that they can do in this show. So we see Maria kind of step up into that spotlight here, and, you know, there's, I guess, power's up for grabs here. Caputo grabs his share of the power. Now Maria trying to mm-hmm. grab her lion's share of the power, you know, among the other inmates.
Right. And it's interesting that you say, you know, we have all this rich cast of characters going on. And it's kind of interesting that I was a little surprised because I was, you know, when there's a flashback, you're always thinking, oh, has this person had a flashback before? What else has we seen? And it was kind of surprising to see that we hadn't had a flashback from Maria before, since she is, even though she hasn't really had a ton of screen time, her screen time has been very emotional. It's very easy to connect mm-hmm. to. And kind of when you said, you know, the time her partner came and told her that the baby wouldn't be coming to see her anymore, I actually, the very first time I really connected with Orange is the New Black, I think, is, or at least definitely cried. I cry a lot of TV shows, but I cried a lot when
it happens.
The first season
it
when
happens.
It happens. And it's good. It's cathartic, I think. But when Maria, she's pregnant for, you know, a portion of this first season, and then she goes to the hospital and she comes back, and they wheel her into the TV room, and she's just broken. And, you know, she went to the hospital, had a baby, and her whole body is screaming out for a child, but she can't have it. And, you know, that happens to women in women's prisons all around the country, because, you know, they'll go in pregnant, or, you know, and then they're not going to see their child for a long time. And that was, you know, a way, that was definitely a way that viewers really connected with Maria. And then, like you said, the heart-wrenching part where, you know, her husband's not going to bring her child, or her partner, I'm not sure if they're married, but not going to bring her child to see her anymore. And that's what she was living for. So here we see Maria, and we see her kind of out of that maternal role, and she's a little hopeless, and she doesn't really have anything to fight for anymore. So why not? Why not be powerful? Why not kind of play the role that her father played outside, and, you know, see where that takes her?
Yeah, it's you know, those early scenes, you know, we didn't really know her, but we were able to empathize with her, sympathize with her, that whole maternal bond, and she was apart from her child. And then also in season two or episode two, you know, we see the conversation with Alita and Daya early on, where Daya is mad at Alita for mm-hmm. Caesar getting arrested, who was supposed to be watching after Daya's child after they went against the plans of putting the baby up for adoption. At the end of season three, Alita says the baby died in childbirth, and you know, pulling Stash's mom was not going to adopt the child and raise it well and give it everything it could ever need. So Daya, she's blaming her mom for all of her problems and, you know, not taking any accountability for her actions or anything like that. So Daya's really not giving us that same kind of sympathetic kind of mother without her child, you know, kind of character here, like we saw from Maria early on. But you know, still, it's a mom who just gave birth, who is without her child, and now doesn't know who is really taking care of her child after, mm-hmm. you know, after Caesar got apprehended or arrested. So it's you know, the emotions are all over the place here, and we're only two episodes in a season mm-hmm. four.
Yeah, and it's interesting, you know, with Daya and Alita, they're kind of on the opposite. They're, you know, they're, I think they're Puerto Rican, so they're landing on, you know, a very different side than Rhea's landing here, and that's definitely going to be interesting to see as the season goes on as well, in terms of the, you know, the clashes between different ethnicities and races and religions, and kind of how this is all a boiling, boiling mess of, you know, of just stress and power struggles. And to kind of go back to what we were talking about before with the race wars, you know, Piper is obviously, she's trying to, you know, be, you know, the big woman on campus at this point in time. And she's kind of trying to strutter stuff. She's not really, you know, she's trying to assert her power in a different way, based on something that all the new inmates don't even know happened, really. They don't know that she sent Stella down to shoot. Piper doesn't necessarily look very intimidating, and she's trying to take advantage of this new situation, but it's definitely not necessarily, it's already showing some signs of cracking, I think.
Yeah, now we could get to Piper, the center of our story here in Orange is the New Black. But man, you'll ask, you know, 10 people who your favorite character is on the show, and you know, we think Piper is the main character, but she's just kind of like one star, you know, in this big ensemble cast. But
I'm definitely someone who dislikes Piper. I don't really love Piper. I said on the first podcast that she was someone who came into my office as a client. When I'm working as a therapist, I would just be like, nope. I mean, obviously, you know, you have to work with who you're given and in settings and, you know, public treatment settings, but I would not have been too excited to see a Piper walk into my office.
She's not a likable person. I mean, she's, you know, the cute blonde and all that, like, had the nice life outside of prison, and she comes in and like, oh, you know, you feel bad for her because, like, oh, she had the great life. Like, and now she's going to jail for a crime that happened like 10 years ago. Like, why even bother? Like, just let her go. Like, she's got a soap business with her best friend. Like, you know, like, let her be. Oh, she's cute. Like, just, you know, leave her alone. But yeah, there's plenty of moments where, you know, I hate Piper. Oh, you know, she stinks. But of course, obviously, in much more harsher language than that. But yeah, you know, we see Piper early in season 4. And, you know, it's that line where she's like, you know, I'm a gangsta, you know, with an A at the end. She thinks she's, you know, living this gangster lifestyle like she's some...
And Tang's like, nope.
Yeah, like, see you later, thug life. But, yeah, she thinks she's this, you know, all-powerful, like, threatening, imposing figure. And it's like, no, you're not. Like, you sent Stella to the shoe. Like, you planted stuff in her bunk to get her sent to the shoe or sent to the max, like, after she had stolen money from you, like, after, like, she had kind of, like, planted a wedge between her and Alex. It's like, you reacted to her doing terrible things to you. It's like, you're not a gangster, you're not a thug, you're not some badass that's gonna, you know, have all these other inmates, like, cowering at your beck and call and this and that. So, it was kind of funny, you know, 20 minutes or so when it's, episode 2, where she's playing gin with Red and Norma, and Red's trying to, like, you know, put her in her own place here. Like, no, like, your power, it's all an illusion. Like what you were saying, like, you know, most of these people don't even know that, you know, what she did to Stella. It's like, certainly none of the new inmates do, but, you know, she's got this, like, false sense of, I guess, superiority here. And we see a totally kind of new attitude from Piper, and it's really grating and aggravating, and you really hate Piper early on in this season. But it was kind of nice to see Red kind of put her in a place here a little bit, and, you know, Red saying, look, my power is no illusion, but yours, you're just still a, you know, a skinny chick with skinny legs here and real no power at all. So that's kind of funny. I mean, Red, she's the real powerful one, and Maria, we might see her kind of, you know, get a share of that power as well in the prison system. But yeah, Piper, she's got no power, and you know, once she realizes what the extent of her powers are, it's going to be a rude awakening for Pipes.
Yeah, and it's definitely kind of what you were saying. You know, she was, oh, poor little white girl going to jail, something she did 10 years ago, and you know, how, like, you know, the system definitely favors white people. It's an unfortunate but realistic truth, and especially white people with money. And Piper was both of those and landed in jail anyway. And she has, you know, she's got all that stuff that white privilege affords her. And she, right here, this is kind of her feeling that entitlement and feeling that, like, oh, I did this one thing, so I can rule the world now. Whereas, you know, someone else would take power in a slightly different way. Red is kind of, you know, Red is kind of someone who's come up a very different way. She's an immigrant. She you know, she was poor, she scrapped her way up, and she's definitely built her empire from nothing, and her power isn't an illusion, because she's earned every single bit of her power. And it's also interesting, they're sitting there with Norma, who, I'm not sure if any of the inmates know exactly what Norma did, but she's a murderer, which
yeah.
is, you know, definitely something a lot more harsh and a lot more serious than anything that Piper did.
Yeah, some of the more mild mannered. I mean, she doesn't speak at all in the entire show, and then she'll sing in like a random, you know, episode. You're like, oh my god, like you should sing like in every episode. But
yeah.
Yeah, some of the people, like I think it was the first season. Gosh, Maureen, when after her and Suzanne Crazy Eyes had their little moment out in the woods or whatever that was not meant to be, and Healy's looking over her file and. You know, you assume like he sees like what she's in Litchfield.
I know, I'm
like,
so curious.
Yeah, it's like it's always, you know, the people you least suspect. So I'm like, okay, did she like gun down like a, you know, like a business or whatever? Like, what did she do? Is she some mass?
Well, she says to
like,
Crazy Eyes that she didn't do anything violent. So
yeah,
and then Crazy Eyes goes, oh, but I did. Or no, she says I didn't hurt anyone, and then Crazy Eyes says, oh, but I did, which is really interesting because mm-hmm. obviously we don't know what she did as of yet, but. But Maureen, you know, it's super interesting to think about all the possible things that could have shocked Caputo, because Caputo sees a lot of stuff.
Right?
And, like, you know, if he's shocked by Maureen, then what does he do?
I know, it just has me waiting for her flashback episode. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, some of these characters, like we were saying with Maria, it took 4 seasons until we got her flashback story. So are you going to be waiting until season 7 until we get Maureen's flashback? You know, it's just one of those unanswered questions that you know, fans are going to be asking themselves, you know, until we do get the answer. But mm-hmm. yeah, you know, so many great characters. Piper, she's a great character, but she's not a very likable person. But yeah, like you were saying, that sense of entitlement there. You know, she's the pretty girl, probably had a lot of things given to her that, you know, other
mm-hmm.
people, and you know, like, you know, all these, you know, minorities that are just, you know, now the minorities aren't the minority in Litchfield. I think there's
right.
a line about that. I can't remember who said it, but yeah, they're taking over. And there's a scene that I mentioned it earlier where they're watching TV, they're watching the soccer game. Blanca's like, no, we're watching this game. And Maria's like, dude, what are you doing? Like, everybody already hates us. Like, now you being, you know, why are you being this way? You know, we don't need more enemies. But then that situation kind of, you know, flipped the switch or lit that fire inside Maria, who she had the falling out with her father that we saw in the flashback. But then it's like she's kind of taking on that kingpin, or, you know, building kind of an empire, or building her own little crew, I guess, if you will, her own little, you know, Maria's gang
mm-hmm.
inside Litchfield, where, you know, she's Breaking Bad, I guess. You know, it's kind of weird to say it for someone who's already in jail, but it's like, well, now she's becoming a super criminal, I guess. And
right.
we saw that scene where they put the bag over Sankey's head and they beat her up, and then we see Maria at the end, you know, sitting next to Block, and it's like, all right, you know, we're going to take things over here. We're going to run things. Things are going to happen on our own terms. And that's going to be a very interesting scenario to see play out, because there's all these different little factions, all these different little groups here, and everybody wants things to go their way. So if one person starts to threaten the other group's way of, I guess, you know, living inside Litchfield, it's just going to create more drama, more conflict, more fights, and, you know, more excitement for us watching on Netflix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and definitely some stress, too. I think the season was one of the more stressful. We won't really get into what goes on, but these episodes are obviously setting, you know, they're setting something up. I know, you know, a lot of people watching the season, I was on Twitter a lot when it first dropped and since then, and people, I think, felt that the first couple episodes were a little slow. And this episode was definitely, you know, definitely not the most exciting episode of Orange is the New Black that we've ever seen. But, you know, we did get a new flashback, and we did see some things, you know, with Maria. But all of that it's building to something. And, you know, these racial conflicts and things like that, they're, you know, building this foundation upon everything else that's going to be, you know, really interesting to see later on in the season. So they're definitely slow, but things are happening and pieces are moving into place. And I'm already kind of watching the season over a second time. And, you know, when you watch it a second time, having watched it all through once, you can kind of appreciate all of the little things that are going on.
Yeah, absolutely. I did the same thing. I just rewatched the second episode about an hour before we recorded this podcast. So, you know, I breezed through the 13 episodes, and I don't know. I think I was done by Saturday night, the day after it was released. So it was a sprint. I mean, you get started. Yeah, it's a little bit slow. You know, after that first episode was just so great. Dealing mm-hmm. with the fallout from everything that happened at the end of. In the season 3 finale, and you kind of get this big, 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 huge moment with Alex and Lolly in the greenhouse, and the dead, well, he's not a guard, but the dead guard sent by Kubra to kill Alex, and, you know, Lolly stomps that guy's throat, and, you know, mm-hmm. Alex has to finish the deed when she goes back to check on the body, and, you know, that's going to be something that lingers, I think, for a long time, because, and you don't just kill somebody and, you know, it's all wrapped up in a nice, you know, 59-minute episode. It's going to be something that I think lingers, not mm-hmm. just throughout season 4, but into season 5 and perhaps, you know, even beyond that, depending on, you know, how the writers decide to attack that storyline. But, a good start, you know, with the first episode. A little bit slower here in the second episode that we're talking about. But, you know, I think the overlying themes were, you know, we're starting to see a lot of segregation here, you know, mm-hmm. with the blacks, the Latinas, and then the whites, and then Judy King being thrown in the mix here.
Oh, yeah,
who's
Judy
just
King.
Getting all her preferential treatment from Caputo at the urging of MTC because they got to make sure they don't have any bad press or any, you know, negative reviews or articles or anything written about them. They got to make sure Judy King is, you know, roll out the red carpet for, you know, the celebrity inmate here.
Mm-hmm. And so she's like the embodiment of white privilege. So
oh, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. And she gets Yoga Jones as a roommate who doesn't really want anything to do with that whole life. She wants to kind of, you know, she's, as we've seen her in previous seasons, she kind of is there to work through her issues, and she's kind of there to kind of deal with what she's done. And she's, you know, she's not really about being treated with kid gloves. She wants to kind of be in the population. So that's also going to be interesting to see play out as well.
Yeah, there was that line. I don't know if I'm saying it verbatim, but she comes in to Judy's bunk or her private room, and it's like, no, I didn't want this. And then Judy's like, well, you didn't say no either. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, well, you know, if I do have this choice of having a coffee maker in my bunk or a nice sunflower, and, you know, I could have a little extra, you know, more room to do my yoga, you know, exercises and whatnot, you know, she's not turning down the opportunity, but maybe she'll feel a little guilty for 20 minutes or so before, you know, embracing these preferential treatments here. But it's an interesting dynamic created between those two. We don't see a whole lot of Yoga Jones. I mean, she's one of those, you know, not even like a secondary character, maybe like, you know, the third or the fourth wave of characters there. But we know enough about her to kind of know her personality, what she's in jail for, you know,
mm-hmm.
you know, what motivates her, I guess. And you know, it's going to be interesting to see now that she is bunking with Judy King, you know, is she going to change? Is she going to stick to, you know, who she made herself out to be? Or if the Judy King influence is going to, you know, make us kind of resent, you know, Yoga Jones, or if it's just going to make us hate Judy King? Because right now I don't have a great first impression of Judy King.
Mm-hmm. No, I love how in the first episode, and we're going back a little bit, but how Lucia kind of put her in her place at the end. They're having this wonderful conversation. Everything's great. And then she's like, oh, we'll talk more. And he was like, we'll see, inmate. And
yeah.
So he's, you know, he's already kind of, you know, putting her where she needs to be. He's really the only one. And that's really the only time that, well, so far that we've seen anyone kind of put her, you know, remind her of where she's supposed to be. Which is definitely fun to see. But it's also interesting, you know, Yoga Jones is she's kind of a peripheral character, but she's also someone who we've never had a flashback from her, but we heard what she did directly from her when she told Watson about, that definitely really stirring moment where the two of them talk about, what she did and how she, killed that child accidentally. And it was really difficult for her. And she had to come to, the realization of some truths in her life. And, like I said, kind of repent for what she did and change her life a little bit. But, there are a couple of those characters like Geoga Jones and Frida, who, the one who helped Alex and Molly bury, chop up and bury the guard.
Yeah.
They kind of own what they did. We don't really ever have to see it because they tell us. And then there are other inmates that, we still don't know what they did because they don't want that to define who they are.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, just the way Geoga Jones was breaking down, she killed a little boy, accidentally. It's like that scene, her account of it was better than, we didn't need to visually see that to understand it and to get it. So, it was, it's pretty powerful. I can't remember if that was season 2 or 3 or
I think it's season 1.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't think it was season 3. So I knew it was a while back, but yeah, it was so powerful, and it's like, yeah, there's still so many characters that we enter season 4 and we still don't know exactly why Suzanne is Nolan Litchfield. And she's a 2-time Emmy winner, for crying out loud. So
right, that's true. That's very true.
Yeah, she might be, the favorite character of, a lot of Orange is the New Black fans. I mean, she is just phenomenal. But, entering into season 4, she's, one of, a handful or a dozen characters that we aren't exactly sure why she's locked up. So
and we've only had one flashback from her, right? I think in season 2, was it season 2 with her and her parents, or maybe it was season 3. No, it was season 2. With her,
yeah, where
her parents,
she's like a little girl, yeah.
And then she's got her mom issues.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
Stems over to Piper and all the blonde girls that she likes. So
Dandelion.
That's actually, sorry?
I said, oh, when she would call Piper Dandelion.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it's kind of funny that Maureen is also, blonde lady, and, maybe that's part of the attraction.
She's definitely got a type, that's for sure.
All those mom issues coming to surface,
yeah.
which is definitely interesting. But yeah, we haven't seen what she did either. And even in this episode, we don't actually get to see what Maria did either. We kind of just have to assume, she got caught up in her boyfriend's business or her husband or her father's business
in the drug
or
game.
Something. In the drug game. And actually the previous episode of the podcast, before I even recorded it, my friend Ed and I were talking about the characters on the show, and actually we forgot to kind of talk about it on the podcast. And since you're a male, I would definitely like to ask you, we were talking a little bit about how the male figures on the show, none of them are really positive. They're all really kind of negative guys that kind of get the women into difficult situations, or they're manipulative, or they're just, worthless, kind of like Healy. How, as a male, how do you kind of feel about that watching the show, especially when, the main cast of characters are women, but all the peripheral males don't really seem to be shown in any sort of positive light?
Wow, that's a great question and something I haven't really given much thought about too, but yeah, okay, let's break this down. I'm gonna go back to flashback to season 1 and I guess Porn Stash, Mendez. I mean, he was probably one of the first villains, true villains on the show. I mean, just a terrible guy. I mean, and then flash forward again to season 4, and it's similar problems with the correctional officers. I mean, really, all of the new guards. I mean, we saw Coates at the end of, or in season 3, he rapes Doggett, but he doesn't really think it was rape. He just, he's like, well, I like you, so if it was rape, then. And then, Healy and Caputo, we've already talked about. Some of the moments you see from the correctional officers this season are just, man, it's, gosh, it's brutal. But then also, gosh, all these guys, Bennett, I mean, we thought, oh, this nice, sweet guy, he really likes Daya, and oh, man, he made a little, like, fake homemade, like, ring for her out of a gum wrapper and you know, all this stuff. It's like, oh, man, like, maybe he's actually, like, a good guy. But then, you know, we see his true colors, and we saw that flashback when he was in the military. Like, okay, this guy is, you know, this guy's a runner. Like, he can't, you know, he's a coward. You know, he's a fraud. So we saw that. Gosh, you know, I'm trying to think of, like, more, like.
Well, even Larry in the first two seasons, I think. You don't really see him at all in the third or fourth, thank God, because he was awful. But, but you know, he's really – he's really not that bad of a guy, but he's just not, you know, he's not likable in any way either. So, you know, none of these men are people that we can kind of grab onto. And that's, I mean, I personally, as a woman, I definitely kind of think that's okay, because a lot of times women are unlikable on television shows. And here we have this whole cast of women that are, you know, varying degrees. They're likable. We want to root for some of them, and some of them, like, you know, Piper, I don't. But you know, the men on the show, we just don't. And, you know, we're talking a lot about Caputo today. Caputo was definitely one of those guys that we could root for, but he's kind of turning a little bit in this season. So it's just interesting to see that the men are not really painted in. They're painted kind of more as villains than anything else.
It's kind of weird that, like, you know, I'm, like, jogging through the Rolodex of all the male characters on the show, and, like, Caesar, like, okay, yeah, this, like, little, like, drug lord, empire, drug dealer, wannabe Pablo Escobar or whatever, like, terrible dude, right? But, like, he was also, like, taking care of, like, 15 kids from, like, so many different women. So it's like, well, okay, like, terrible dude, but, like,
well, he was threatening to shoot them when they didn't. Yeah, but he was threatening to shoot them when they didn't eat their French fries and stuff. So.
Yeah, I mean, have you ever had French fries over microwave? I mean, come on, they're pretty bad. But no, that's a great point too. But it's like, that also just kind of shows, like, wow, I had, like, a brief thought that maybe Caesar is, like, one of the better guys on this show, but he's also
more likable.
Yeah, exactly. And gosh, who are some of the other male characters on this show? Larry, yeah, like you said, he was just kind of like, whatever, you know. It's like, he does tell Piper that Alex was the one that named her. Like, he was kind of, you know, he was kind of a jerk how he did that. And then and then he goes and hooks up with Polly while she's married. And, like, oh, yeah, like, that's not a very nice thing to do, to, like, shack up with your fiance's best friend while she's in jail. Like, and then, like, she was married and, like, just had a baby. So, like, that's not, you know, a great example of, like, somebody that you'd want on TV, or somebody that'd be like, oh, man, that's a good representation of what a guy should be like. So,
and actually, as you said,
Piper's,
like, running through the Rolodex,
yeah.
Piper's
dad
is awful. But her brother, Cal, is actually not a bad guy.
Hey, he hooked up the secret panty business. I mean, he found the panty guy, he got the money, and, you know, until Stella stole it. It looked like he was doing Piper a solid, he and his his new bride, you know, making money from their parents' basement. So, man, if that's, gosh, I'm trying to think of the other guys, but if Cal is one of the best dudes on the show, that's probably not good. But, yeah, you know,
I like Cal.
Piper's dad, yeah, cheats on Piper's mom, and then Piper's mom is like, well, I'll just pretend like it didn't happen, and we'll just carry on with Sunday dinner. But, yeah, not a lot of... Yeah, I'm trying to think, is, you know, I jogged through the mental Rolodex here, but not a whole lot of redeeming characters here. From you know, Luzchek, you know, he rats on Nikki, and then sends Nikki to Max. I mean, you know, he tries to redeem himself, but it, you know, I think it's just to clear his guilty conscience. But he's not a good guy. Yeah, maybe Orange is the New Black. I'll start a new conspiracy. Orange is the New Black hates all men.
I wouldn't go that far.
Maybe I can get it trending.
Yeah, I just thought it was interesting because I really had never, you know, as a woman, I'm focusing on the female stories, and I had never really looked at it from that perspective. But kind of like you said, when I was running through all the male characters, I didn't really see too many redeeming qualities in any of them. But at the same time, you know, everyone on the show is pretty complex and has, you know, redeeming qualities and negative qualities as well. And there's really no, you know, even in the female population, now that I'm thinking about it, there's no one that's purely good. But, you know, we do see the women being victimized by the men a lot. And that is something that happens in society. But I feel like maybe a little too much of the two genders sort of, you know, talking and interacting, a lot of that is based on, you know, males kind of taking advantage of women, which is interesting to see. And definitely a needed thing in today's culture and climate. But it's also, you know, something that's focused on quite a lot.
Yeah, and the males definitely take advantage of the females in this season, you know, especially, you know, we can't get into it now because we don't want to spoil it for the listeners, but yeah, it's, you know, the men aren't going to redeem themselves, really. And, you know, if you thought the men were bad now, it's just going to get worse, but yeah, you know, like you said, you know, the women, they aren't exactly, you know, great people either. I mean, they are in jail, so, you know, that's, you know, that they already got a big strike against them, but, you know, you kind of find yourselves rooting more for the inmates than you do for, you know, Caputo and the guards and, you know, everybody that, you know, are, you know, in essence, the good guys. So it kind of flips the script on us as a viewer, but we do try to find the redeeming qualities in the inmates, you know, even after Alex kills the guy. It's like, well, she was justified in murdering that
guy.
Like, the guy tried to kill her first, so... You know, outside of V in season two, there really hasn't been like a huge like villain as far as like the inmates are concerned. You know, there's like, you know, maybe somebody will do a bad thing in episode, you know, in one episode or another, or they're just kind of, you know, a jerk or whatnot, but not like
female
characters.
V was a big one.
Oh yeah, she was terrible. As soon as she was introduced, I could not wait for her to meet her maker. And I thought that was one of the cooler death scenes. We haven't had a lot of the inmates die on this show. It's not like The Walking Dead or Game of Thrones where you have to kind of brace yourself for like six of your favorite people to die like in the next hour. But,
right.
There have been some deaths on this show. And when Miss Rosa, you know, drove that van and just ran her over on the side of the road, that was one of those moments where you're like, yes, as a viewer, and you're just like applauding. So, I mean, that was awesome. I mean, you know, V, she was terrible. I mean, turn Tasty against, you know, Poussey and Cindy and all her other friends. And, you know, when we learned in V's flashback, she's just a terrible person. So,
And women can be terrible too. So, that's,
you know,
it's
an equal opportunity.
Yeah.
Plenty of blame to go on both sexes, but that's a great point about the male characters on this show. Nobody with, you know, really any redeeming qualities. Oh, now that I think about it, Danny from season three played, you know, Mike Pataglia character, you know, the son of, I guess, the MCC director or whatever his official job title is. He's kind of working alongside Caputo. He was Caputo's boss, technically, but he's kind of in over his head, but he had the prison, like, he was like, look, we need to, you know, they might be prisoners, but they're still human beings, and, you know, we can't feed them this food that's in a bag that you just boil. It's like, and you can't just send Sophia to the shoe because she was assaulted. Like, you know, you can't do that. So maybe Danny is, you know, the best guys on Orange is the New Black, and, you know, that's fine with me because I love Mike Birbiglia.
Oh, yeah, he's great. He's really, you know, he definitely managed to bring a lightness to the show last season when there was a lot of negativity going on. So, and I think I don't think it's a spoiler to say we will see him a little bit later in the season, and he's, you know, he's still a good guy. So I think that's definitely, you know, one of the positive male role models on the show. So
definitely,
it's a good thing. Well, to kind of conclude, I know we talked a little bit about when we were setting the interview, this, you know, conversation up about the mental health article. There's an article in Rolling Stone, and I should have it up on my computer, but it was about, you know, bringing mental health into entertainment a little bit more. And, you know, it was talking more about shows like Lady Dynamite and shows on Netflix, like I think also a little bit about BoJack Horseman. But it seems like Netflix, you know, with Orange is the New Black and these two other shows, they definitely have room to play with that idea in their formats. And I think, you know, I definitely think that's a great thing.
Yeah. With, you know, Maria Bamford, she was in a mental facility, I think two or three or four times, maybe, I'm trying to remember. she talked about it in Lady Dynamite, the Netflix mm-hmm. show, you know, as we talk about Orange is the New Black on Netflix. So, yeah, Netflix is kind of, I don't know if it was intentional or not, but, I mean, the two shows came out, you know, within a month of each other, so it's fresh on everybody's memory. It's, you know, two of the more popular shows on Netflix, especially Orange is the New Black. But Lady Dynamite, a newer show, maybe people know Maria Bamford from, you know, the old Target commercials or she's in a couple episodes of Arrested Development. But, yeah, she had hypermania, I think it was her diagnosis, and I think bipolar disorder. I can't remember exactly. I don't want to say one thing when it's wrong. But yeah, so she needed, you know, help to treat her, you know, mental health. And, you know, we see that in Orange is the New Black with, you know, Suzanne, obviously she's got some, you know, some mental health obstacles that she's had to deal with that we've known about from the first three seasons. Lolly, obviously, we saw a lot more of her character in season three after just getting a little taste of her in season two when she was on the flight with Piper when they were transferring her after the fight at the end of season one. But, yeah, we see Lolly, you know, she's, you know, paranoid, delusional, schizophrenic. You know, I'm not a doctor, but she's hearing voices and she's paranoid. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's interesting how the, you know, whether or not, you know, it's a huge, huge, huge conversation that spawns from this. It's like, all right, what do we do with these people that have, you know, mental health, you know, related issues here? Do we punish them by locking them up and throwing away the key here and, you know, leave them in maximum security here? Or do we treat them? Do we send them to therapists? Do we try to, you know, do we need to educate ourselves here first before we can really help them out? So, you know, it's a big issue here that's going to be a huge, huge, huge heavy hitter here as we progress on through season four. But it's, you know, it's a debate and it's a conversation that, you know, we could probably talk about for hours on end. But I guess, long story short, it's, gosh, it's just grab the Kleenex box here because it's going to be heavy hitting stuff here, not just with the inmates, but also with the prison workers themselves.
Definitely. And you know, it's interesting, you know, we've talked a little bit about Lady Dynamite, but, you know, in Lady Dynamite, she, you know, Maria Bamford's character, I think she's Maria Bamford, she, you know, she does things that are a little questionable and potentially, you know, like these other people on Orange is the New Black, some of them, you know, in real life, a lot of times people get locked up, you know, things they do with their mental health disorders. Things, like you said, we'll find out a little bit more about that a little later in the season this year. But sometimes they don't really do anything, and they get locked up because of something that was misunderstood, or, you know, because there's not, you know, our officers aren't really trained to be sensitive to those mental health issues. So, you know, some people on these shows, you know, the article mentions, you know, You're the Worst as well, which is a show on FX that also deals with severe mental health. Yeah, it's a really great show, and it went really in-depth about depression this year, but the main character there, Gretchen, she does a lot of terrible things that should probably get her arrested, but she ends up getting out of them. And a lot of times, you know, there's a fine line between, you know, the people in jail and the people outside of jail in terms of mental health problems, or even people not with mental health problems. It's just, you know, a lot of times the people with mental health problems are misunderstood, or they don't have an advocate, and they end up in jail instead of, you know, getting treatment or getting what they need, which is really a hard reality to face.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. You know, it's, you know, maybe people don't understand what these people are dealing with, so they just, oh, they're different, or, you know, they get labeled as quote unquote, oh, they're just crazy. You know, it's like Suzanne, you know, she's been called Crazy Eyes for, you know, going on four seasons now. But, you know, that's a highly offensive term to someone that's suffering from mental health.
Right.
You know, so it's kind of great that, you know, shows like Lady Dynamite, You're the Worst, Orange is the New Black. I mean, shoot, go back 10, 15 years with The Sopranos, where, you know, Tony Soprano is, you know, I guess, you know, we think of him, oh, he's the big mob boss, but he was, you know, a big part of that show was the therapy and, you know, all the sessions that he goes through for the entire length of the series, you know, does, and whether or not he still thinks he needs it. Like, you know, is he quote unquote cured? Like, oh, I'm fixed now, so I don't need to do this anymore. But, you know, maybe that's something that there is no quote unquote cure. You're not quote fixed, but it's just something you're constantly treating and coping with and dealing with. But it's kind of cool that these shows are kind of bringing the conversation forward. We're having a conversation about it now, and
exactly.
You know, our conversation will spur more conversations about it. And you know, instead of being or feeling ostracized because you know you have you suffer from depression or you're bipolar or whatever the case may be, maybe you don't need to feel different. You don't need to feel like, or you don't need to make other people feel like, oh, you're a threat to me because, oh, you have bipolar. Oh, you're crazy. Oh, I don't want to deal with you. Mm-hmm. So it's nice and cool in the sense that these shows can serve as kind of like an outlet or like a visual walking representation of, oh, here's someone with bipolar disorder. Here's someone that's, you know, hypomania. Here's someone that's a schizophrenic. So it's like, oh, well, you know, they're not, you know, crazy. They're not flying off the walls. They don't need to be in a straitjacket in a padded cell, but they do need treatment. They need, mm-hmm. you know, whether it be medication or just, you know, therapy and, you know, talking or whatever the case may be. But I guess it's good that the conversation is out there. It's being started instead of just kind of like, you know, kind of go full circle here, kind of with like Caputo, where you just kind of brush it under the rug and mm-hmm. kind of forget about this problem and hope it'll just go away on its own.
Right. And TV, you know, didn't really focus on those people. Or if they did, they were, you know, sort of cartoonized. They were like, you know, the max of what they could be, or, you know, schizophrenic people were villains, or, you know, it wasn't as subtle and nuanced as it is today on TV. And I definitely think that it's great that we're, you know, like you said, we're having these conversations and we're seeing those types of people on TV because they exist, and it's way easier to brush it under the rug than it is to sort of bring it out and talk about it and talk about change. So I think that's super exciting. And we'll see more about that in Orange is the New Black as it progresses into the season and into, I think it's been renewed for 3 more seasons after this. So that's super exciting too.
Yeah, it's great. We could just be, you know, at the halfway point here where season 4 kind of serves as like the fulcrum here of the show. We had the first 3 seasons and it was, you know, a great comedy, but also those great dramatic moments here, you know, touched in like we talked about with Maria and motherhood and all that stuff. But yeah, you know, season 4 here, you know, first 2 episodes in here that, you know, we talked about this season, we got a murder, we got a budding race war, you know, a potential, religious war here going on here. So it's some heavy hitting topics here, not just, you know, how's Piper going to get enough employees or how's she going to smuggle out, you know, these panties to make money? So it's like, you know, the subject matter here, instead of being a, you know, lighthearted, playful, silly, you know, stuff, it's like, oh, yeah, these women are locked up. They are prisoners. They are criminals here. You know, let's address some stuff that is really going on inside prisons, you know, really going on with the prison system, with inmates, the recidivism. You'll have to say it for me. I know how to spell it.
You're going to get it. You're
going to
get it.
Yeah, recidivism, right? Yeah, okay.
Yep.
And all that stuff. So it's, you know, it's you know, I don't want to say finally addressing real life, real world issues, but it is, and just, you know, full, you know, they're flooring it here. They're just smashing mm-hmm. that gas pedal here, full steam ahead here, you know, 2 episodes, 2 hours into season 4. And, man, if you thought the first 2 episodes were great, just keep with it. If you haven't binge-watched it already, you know, I've said in my review, I thought this was the best season yet of Orange is the New mm-hmm. Black. And I got some scuttle back from that because it was different. Tonally, it had a much different feel than the first 3 seasons where there were more laughs than there was heartache. But mm-hmm. from the storytelling and just, the real world issues that I thought this season addressed, I thought it was phenomenal.
It was. I was very impressed. I think it's kind of, it's difficult when Orange is the New Black gets released, I think, because so for the Emmys, which, I mean, this is definitely all entertainment talk, but for the Emmys, the voting period is going on right now, but they're not voting for this season of Orange is the New Black. They're voting for the previous season, which is like a frustrating thing because I feel like people who watch it, this season is fresh on their minds and the 3rd season isn't necessarily so fresh on their minds. So we're going to have to wait until 2017 to see if this season of Orange is the New Black gets all the accolades that it deserves.
Oh, and it's definitely deserving of plenty of accolades. I mean, You know, we've seen Suzanne, her character, already win, you know, 2 Best Supporting Actress awards. I think she's got a great case to win a third one, but, you know, to go back to how great this cast is, you know, you could have 2, 3, 4 other actresses from this show, you know, get an Emmy nomination here. So,
I think they put up 9 this year.
Wow.
That's
awesome.
And that's like a low ball estimate too, because there's so many fantastic performances on the show. But I do believe I saw like a 4-year consideration poster that was a grid with 9 different faces on it.
Wow. It's kind of like Modern Family, where it's like, you know, you could have 3 Best Supporting Actor, you know, nominations from that show. And it's like, wow, all 3 of them should win. You know, I think we've seen all 3 of those actors on Modern Family win, or they've all at least been nominated. At least 2 of them have won. I know Ty Burrell and Eric Stone should have won, but yeah, you talk about Orange is the New Black. I thought, you know, Alex's storyline this season, it was, I thought, her best yet. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if Preepon was nominated. Red, obviously, every year she's, you know, she's worthy. You know, Crazy Eyes, you already talked about, but yeah, it's, maybe those 3 should be. Lori Petty, phenomenal this season, plays Lolly. She was phenomenal. So some great, great, great acting, some great writing, great direction. And, you know, that's all part of the reason why I thought this was the best season. So, you know, that's why it makes talking about one singular episode, you know, for an hour or so, like, so easy to do. It's just, you know, when things are great, it's easy to talk about. When things are bad, it's like, well, this show sucks, you know. And then, like, that's it. You can put a bow on that. But, yeah, Orange is the New Black, just so outstanding.
And it is, and I love the fact, I love the fact that it kind of started the binge culture, but I also, you know, the podcast, one of the reasons I wanted to start it is because I think with when people binge it, they kind of forget to have those conversations about it. Because, you know, if Orange is the New Black came out every week, like Game of Thrones or Walking Dead, people would obsess over it all week. They'd be like, oh, okay, like Maria did this and then she moved like that, and what does that mean? And, you know, every single thing would be broken down. And instead we binge it really quickly in, you know, weekend, and absorb it really fast, and we miss all of that nuance and detail, which I think, you know, that's what we're talking about now. So I'm glad that you know, I'm glad that you were able to talk to us, and I think we did it.
I think we covered
episode 2.
Yeah, I think we nailed it.
But yeah, but I'm definitely going to be linking to some of your Netflix Life content in the you know, in the post for the episode, and this should go up tomorrow at some point. So that'll be, I think, Wednesday, June 28th. I think it's tomorrow, something like that. But thank you so much for being on the podcast, and I really appreciate it. I think, you know, we had a great conversation.
Yeah, my pleasure. Hopefully we could do it again, because that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, this is great.